Thank you very much. You're listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM.
Welcome to The Rift, a radio show about climate change, ecology, politics, and power. My name is Roshan Krishnan, and you're listening to WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM here in East Central Illinois, and streaming all over the world at weft.org. Today is Sunday, March 1st, and this is Episode 8 of The Rift. When we think about the large-scale social and political dimensions of climate change, we often gravitate toward its impact on the economy, and for good reason. Over the last several centuries, most of the global economy has been drawn into capitalism, such that it is now the world's dominant mode of production. And in the last half century or so, capitalism has rapidly become increasingly globalized and financialized. Today, practically everything from buying a house to renting an apartment to just buying groceries is entangled in a complex web of global supply chains, all tied to markets where shares of companies, speculative assets, and even debt itself are bought and sold as financial products. As distant as all this may seem from discussions of nature, ecology, and climate change, the reality is that it probably shouldn't be. Strip away the multiple layers of abstraction, and you're left with a production, distribution, and exchange of goods and services derived from the Earth's resources and subject to the Earth's climatic systems. As the climate changes, so does our ability to produce, distribute, and trade those goods and services. The global financial system is composed of companies invested with various degrees of separation in commodities like oil, timber, agricultural products, and minerals. If the availability or price of those commodities is destabilized, so too is the value of your investment, the value of your company, and the value that anyone derives from their investment in your company. And nothing promises to destabilize things quite like climate change. A paper published last year at the Potsdam Institute for Climate Research found that climate change could result globally in $38 trillion annually in damages by 2050. We're already seeing many of these damages manifest. On the very first episode of The Rift, which, by the way, you can access along with all other previous episodes on the podcast platform of your choosing, I spoke with researcher Moira Burse about the financial risk that climate change-driven disasters pose to the insurance industry. And just weeks ago, we saw wildfires ravage Los Angeles County, producing hundreds of billions of dollars in damages. These kinds of climate damages obviously have severe, immediate effects on individuals' and families' financial situations, whether it's through losing a home entirely, not being adequately compensated by insurance, or facing medical bills and debt. But you may be wondering, if you're a normal American who isn't investing in stocks and bonds, why investment risk specifically would matter to you? Well, one answer is that if you are of the many Americans who participate in a retirement plan, the money you're counting on to carry you through retirement years from now will likely be subject to significant climate risk. According to the U.S. Census Bureau's Survey of Income and Program Participation, 56% of American households participate in a retirement plan. Often, that means an employer-sponsored savings plan like a 401k or a pension that a worker expects to deliver payments once they reach retirement age. But what does it mean for the money you expect to carry you through retirement to be invested in a financial system that bears the risk of climate change? To find out, I spoke with Allie Lindstrom, a senior strategist for the Sustainable Finance Program at the Sierra Club, a national environmental advocacy nonprofit, and co-author of their new report on the climate risk embedded in public pension funds. After the break, you'll hear our conversation about what the report found, what sustainable investing might really look like, and how workers can look to protect themselves from climate-related financial risk. But first, this hour of programming is brought to you in part by the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. March at the Krannert Center features Lyric Theater at Illinois' celebration of Mardi Gras with Carnival on March 4th. Food with Jeff Sobel from March 6th through the 8th, and Germany's Aris Quartet with the Jupiter String Quartet on March 13th. Complete information on these performances is available online at krannertcenter.com. Programming at WEFT is also brought to you in part by Live Action Games. If you're looking for a wide selection of classic and modern video games, consoles, controllers, books, and collectibles, Live Action Games has got you covered. Live Action Games is open Tuesday through Saturday at 111 North Market Street in downtown Champaign, right next door to us here at WEFT. New and gently used inventory arrives daily. For a list of in-stock items or additional Live Action Games information, please visit lag217.com or call 217-359-4863. That's 217-359-GAME. And now, here's my conversation with Allie Lindstrom of the Sierra Club. I'm joined now by Allie Lindstrom, a senior strategist on the Sustainable Finance Campaign at the Sierra Club. Allie, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So just to kind of jump right into it, and especially for those who might not know, can you tell me what exactly a pension fund is and how they're relevant to the ordinary person?
Yes. So public pension funds are the retirement plans that benefit public sector workers. Traditionally, they are also referred to as defined benefit plans, which guarantee a pensioner a reliable and fixed income upon retirement. So public pension funds are made up of the deferred wages of public sector workers and contributions from their employer, which in this case is the state, both of which represent tax dollars. And so even if you don't work for the state, your tax dollars might be going into paying for these retirement plans.
Great. So how does that differ from, say, a 401k or the type of retirement plan someone working in the private sector might be more likely to have?
To put it simply, pension funds, when they still operate as defined benefit plans, offer a guaranteed retirement benefit. 401ks, on the other hand, rely on employee contributions. Usually they're voluntary, and sometimes they're matched by an employer, and these are then invested by a third party or a manager. And in a 401k, the amount a worker can expect to have saved up for retirement is not set or guaranteed, and it depends on the success of those investments and the contributions made. In other words, 401ks and similar plans make management of retirement savings and the risks associated with those investments the responsibility of the worker.
Got it. And that kind of ties into my next question about the history of pensions and the particular way that they've kind of become tied to public sector unions in the U.S. And as anyone who works in the private sector and might have a retirement plan is probably familiar with, you're seeing a 401k. You might see a 403b if you work at a nonprofit or something like that. But since just about the 70s, pensions have been more or less replaced by these financialized funds in the private sector. But public sector unions have fought pretty hard to keep their pension plans alive. What can you tell me about the benefits that organized labor sees in keeping those pension plans and how they've fought to keep them?
I am certainly not an expert on the history of union organizing to protect public pension funds, but it's widely known that it has long been a project of conservative politicians to undermine and under-resource public pension funds. And public sector unions have long fought to protect workers' retirement benefits. As I mentioned earlier, public pension funds guarantee a benefit to their plan participants and have staff and boards who are dedicated to fulfilling that promise. 401ks and defined contribution plans, however, shift responsibility and risk to workers who are not necessarily investment professionals, but still deserve a dignified retirement. Because pensions guarantee a reliable benefit upon retirement, union organizers have a vested interest in preserving them.
So your report looked into the level of climate risk to which these pension funds expose their beneficiaries, essentially the extent to which climate change could threaten the value of the investments that all of these workers are relying on to fund their retirements. Could you talk a little bit about what you ended up finding?
Our report looked at the way pension funds are responding to the well-established risk of climate change with their shareholder rights. So we point to studies and research from the Financial Stability Oversight Council, the UN, the Institute of Faculty and Actuaries, and other academic institutions, all of which point to a massive financial cost of unmitigated climate change. And by this, I don't mean the financial costs to individual companies or pensions, although that impact will be felt. I mean the impact to the whole economy. And these studies predict between 11 and 50% loss in GDP, depending on the time frame that they're looking at or the models they use. And all of them point to persistent long-term economic headwinds. And the pension policies we reviewed, by contrast, largely failed to establish how they expected the companies in their portfolios to address and mitigate these risks. And what many pensions desperately need to do is acknowledge that climate change threatens the long-term health of their portfolios. And following that, pensions must acknowledge that they have a critical role to play in engaging with the companies they're invested in and to hold them accountable to address those threats.
So I'm curious, you laid out before that pension plans, in contrast to something like a 401k, they offer defined benefit plans, and that means you're guaranteed a certain benefit. What might that actually mean for workers' pensions in practice?
This is a question that we grapple with daily, and I can say that there are many companies that will fail to transition into a new clean energy economy or will face extreme physical impacts from climate change. Those physical risks could look like threats to factories from things like sea level rise, wildfires, or flooding. And these are climate risks we're already really familiar with that will impact everyday people and our homes and livelihoods. But for investors, they also need to look at the way businesses in their portfolio will be impacted. And if companies fail to address these risks, investors could lose out. And what our report and the studies I mentioned earlier emphasize is that the entire economy will be impacted by climate change because it relies on a healthy planet and workforce. And in a disorderly transition to a clean energy economy, there won't be a way for investors to avoid that risk or to have some strategy that helps them select a few winners and avoid losers. Because that risk, it's portfolio-wide. And should we reach that point, the state will have to make up the difference to keep that promise to pensioners. And that would set pension systems up for a tough budget fight in a world where we're also facing all sorts of rising costs from repairing from climate damages.
Yeah, it also strikes me that as we're in the middle of dismantling all kinds of federal capacity and slashing budgets, it's hard to imagine that pensioners' benefits would actually end up being guaranteed if we sort of depend on the state to make up the difference after these markets fail. I'm curious about whether or how pension funds have had to respond to heightened risk, be that environmental or geopolitical, in the past. I'm thinking particularly of the oil crises back in the 70s, but really any other examples you can think of. These pension funds, they've become more and more exposed to global financial markets over time as the economy has kind of liberalized and globalized. Have they ever had to deal with situations similar to what they're kind of looking at now?
Public pensions are impacted by economic recessions and market downturns. And depending on the fund and their investment strategy, those can increase the amount of what's called unfunded liabilities that they have. So that's the gap between the amount of money they owe pensioners and retirees and the money they are expecting to have at the time they need to pay. And when this happens, it exposes the pension fund to legislative scrutiny and the potential for reform, which is not always to the benefit of the worker. And it might also encourage the pension fund to take on higher risk and potentially higher return investments and to move into things like private equity. And so we've seen some ways in which market downturns can impact pension funds. However, the long-term economic headwinds of unmitigated climate change are going to be, for lack of a better word, unprecedented in scale. And what a lot of us who do this work are already thinking about is how much the impacts of climate change are going to threaten the whole economy. And this is still something that a lot of people, including retirees and the people responsible for managing their pensions, just haven't quite wrapped their heads around. And with specific crises in the past, like you've mentioned, whether it's the oil crisis in the 1970s or the global financial crisis in 2009, where pensions were impacted, it's going to be different. The climate change is that it's a persistent decline in GDP. It's a persistent increase in natural disaster risk. And there won't be a short but quite harmful drop in the global economy, but rather a persistent struggle to bounce back.
Got it. So one of the things that you highlighted in the report in terms of mitigating some of that climate risk amongst pension funds is this practice of proxy voting. Can you tell me more about that and how you think it can help mitigate some of this climate risk?
Yeah. So investors who own shares of public companies have what are called shareholder rights, which allow them to elect the board of directors at public companies and to vote on key issues brought before the board. These are often in the form of what are called shareholder resolutions. And those resolutions will cover issues that investors think are important for companies to address. And that can include things like disclosing emissions or reporting on supply chain threats, on workforce concerns and union busting, or various plans to address risk to the company's value or bottom line. And this is a key venue for investors to raise concerns with companies about irresponsible business practices or how company behavior impacts the whole economy and investors' portfolios. And investors have an opportunity with these rights to vote for directors who have a better understanding of climate risks and they can advocate for strong climate transition plans and disclosures. Investors can also ask companies to align their lobbying practices with their climate commitments and disclose to investors how they are making political donations. So essentially, proxy voting is the main way that investors have to hold companies accountable, and it's something that requires consistent engagement and effort.
So that sort of brings me to this question of ESG, which stands for, as I'm sure you know, environmental, social, and governance. And in the financial world, it typically refers to investment policy that supposedly prioritizes environmental and social issues. So for example, investors rating companies on various criteria related to their environmental impact and investing in them or not investing in them accordingly. So I guess first off, how do you feel that that idea relates to what you're asking of proxy voters? And how would you say that evolution of that idea has affected how pension funds and other financial actors perceive climate risk relative to their investments?
ESG policies generally help identify risks to individual companies based on whether or not they have responsible business practices. However, as investors learn more about system-level risks, like climate change, and how that will threaten the entire economy and their portfolios, ESG ratings don't cover that. And they can sometimes be a bit of a buzzword that doesn't really help investors identify or address the wider impacts of a company's bad behavior. So, for example, a company that bulldozes a rainforest and displaces an indigenous community, they might get a low ESG score, but it'll be due to potential legal or reputational risks, and it won't be because of the long-term damage that they've caused to ecosystems or human rights. And pension fund managers can use ESG scores to guide some of their engagement with companies in their portfolios and to identify those that are lagging. And it can inform their votes, but it's not adequate or even designed to help pension fund managers address risks that impact their whole portfolio.
Right. Yeah, you're already getting into some of this, but we're in this kind of weird place with ESG right now and corporate climate action more broadly, where we've been seeing a right-wing backlash to these supposedly environmentally friendly practices like ESG and whatnot, and seeing all these companies responding to that backlash by retreating from various climate commitments, net zero emissions reductions, what have you. Those ESG policies and climate commitments were never particularly effective in the first place. There's been, I think, a pretty good amount of research now on, as you kind of indicated, ESG being a little bit more concerned with risks to financial outcomes and the company's stature rather than risks to the environment. Bloomberg produced a report a few years ago that found that there, was more or less no correlation between a company receiving a high ESG rating and their actual performance on environmental issues. And in that way, it's become a sort of form of greenwashing for some of these large companies. So with that knowledge in mind and knowing, what you just said about how this isn't really a reliable indicator for pension funds who might seek to actually mitigate their climate risk, but also knowing that there are ongoing kind of right-wing attacks on this sort of practice, how do you reconcile these problems when you're campaigning on these pension funds? What is the actual objective when it comes to influencing the behavior of these companies?
ESG has certainly faced criticism in recent years, and I'd agree a lot of that criticism is valid, especially that ESG can give companies cover when they're not actually doing that much. It really benefits from being a vague indication of doing good without having specific standards set in place for what constitutes good corporate behavior. And I really appreciate that you brought up the question about efficacy of climate commitments. On the one hand, some commitments don't have a strong strategy behind them, and they'll get dropped when the political winds change. But on the other hand, if we don't have corporate climate commitments, there's not much left for investors to work with. So these are the bigger questions I think about in a lot of the work that I do. And what we've landed on is that no matter what, shareholders should always be calling for increased transparency with companies in order to effectively engage and ultimately demand more robust climate commitments. And we like to think of these commitments as a baseline that investors can use for advocacy. And to tackle that concern, our report offers guidance for the standards that pensions can use in assessing corporate climate commitments and pushing for better. So this includes advocating for climate plans in line with the Paris Agreement and reporting emissions using well-established frameworks that are science-based and comparable across companies. And this can help address some concerns over efficacy, but it really does require consistent investor engagement and a commitment to moving beyond just asking for disclosures of how much a company is emitting to having expectations for companies that they align their business practices with a sustainable future. And if they don't, investors will use other tools available to them to seek that kind of accountability that they need.
So I guess as we're approaching the end of our time here, my sort of burning question is, it sounds like what you are asking for would kind of require a sea change in the approach that investors take. In the sense that right now, when you're constructing an investment portfolio, you're looking at elements like establishing a diversity of sources in your investment. You're looking at balancing risk. You're looking at a lot of things that really don't have much to do with anything related to the environment. So knowing that we're not going to dismantle global finance overnight, as appealing as that might be. What levers do you feel are necessary to bring about that sort of change?
I think it's important to note that public pension funds are some of the largest investors in the world, and how they choose to wield their influence can have significant impacts on the market. So this is a little bit of a apples and oranges comparison. But if you look at all of the pensions that are in our report, which is just over 30, it would be comparable to the total investments of some of the largest asset managers in the world. So think BlackRock, for example. And this isn't a comparison we tend to make often or publicly because it's a little bit confusing, because pensions are also some of the biggest clients of those asset managers. So you're double counting a little bit. But I think it paints a useful picture for how much of a market share is made up of everyday people's retirement savings. And as our report outlined, they need to be doing more to protect those savings of everyday people. And one of the most effective ways for pensions to help protect workers from financial risks like climate change is adopting strong proxy voting guidelines. These are the policies that describe how a pension thinks a company that it invests in should act, the kinds of standards that they have, their expectations, and will determine their votes for the shareholder season. And they can publicly declare what their voting intentions are ahead of key company meetings, and they can advocate for strong federal and state regulations on climate disclosures. And especially important, they can advocate that the managers they work with serve their interests and also start advocating for stronger climate policies. And more pensions are beginning to recognize and act upon the financial risks of climate change, whether because they have staff who are really dedicated to the topic or a trustee who's on the board who's championing issues that the workers are bringing to them. But as the economic risks grow, we desperately need pensions to stop hiding their heads in the sand and step up and start doing more.
Got it. So these pension funds, as you mentioned, they're, I think the comparison to a BlackRock or a Vanguard is really interesting, in that we see those enormous asset managers as what's sometimes called a universal owner, right? Like they've got their fingers in absolutely everything. And being that pension funds are, I don't want to say operating from a similar model, but potentially similarly diversified, what is their level of influence in these, on these corporate boards? You know, one of the arguments that you hear from a BlackRock or a Vanguard is that, you know, we only own like little stakes in these companies. If we say whatever, they don't have to listen to just us. It has to be like this much larger, broader effort. Is there potential for the response to a push from pension funds for climate accountability to be somewhat similar?
We've already seen that right-wing operatives have figured out they can influence asset manager votes. There has been a concerted effort in many states to restrict the ability of public pension funds to consider risks like climate. And they've often included laws or have included actions from attorneys general or state treasurers who identify companies as supposedly boycotting an industry that's politically favorable in their state, whether it's fossil fuel companies or arms manufacturers. And they say, if this financial service provider, like BlackRock, doesn't align itself with our state's political preferences, we won't do business with them. And the asset managers like BlackRock and Vanguard, rather than defending the sound investment criteria they've been using to justify various climate commitments, have immediately walked back most of them and started to offer instead that clients can opt into various strategies. And so the right has effectively said, we won't do business with BlackRock unless it changes its practices. And BlackRock has changed its tune. But there's no reason why investors who are concerned about climate change can't also set expectations of their managers to actually represent them or to seek out new ones. And there's a lot more money in the larger blue states.
Got it. So just to wrap up here, I'm thinking especially of if someone out there is a public sector worker who is poised to receive benefits from one of these pension funds, what do you think that they can do to try to get involved in pushing their pension fund to protect them?
Well, if you're a Sierra Club member, you can contact your local chapter. But one of the many other avenues is if you're in a union working with your local, many of the public pension funds have elected members on their board of trustees who are there to represent worker interests. And they are responsive to the labor constituents that they represent. And many of them are there because they care about fulfilling that promise. And I think it's well worth finding allies on the board or even meeting with staff members in the public pension fund system to express concerns. And I think often you'll find a really sympathetic audience that has to do the due diligence of learning a really complex problem, might not have a climate expertise, but is there to fulfill their duty of providing a reliable retirement and will want to learn how it is that they can champion addressing climate risk, but might need the education from a member or the political support to do so. And one of the ways you can reach them, if you don't have a direct connection through a union, is through public meetings that these pensions have. Often they meet monthly or quarterly or somewhere in between, and they'll publish their agendas ahead of time and often instructions on how the public can come and give public comment and ask for them to do more.
All right. Well, Allie Lindstrom, senior strategist with the Sierra Club, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
That was my conversation with Allie Lindstrom, senior strategist for the Sierra Club's Sustainable Finance Program. Thank you once again to Allie for taking the time to speak with me. The intersection of climate change and global finance has so many dimensions. It exposes the frictions between different groups that have coalesced under modern capitalism. And today you heard one of those perspectives, that of public pensioners in the United States. And that perspective has serious merit. If we don't address the climate risk embedded in pension funds, we face the prospect of an entire generation of workers essentially losing their retirement savings amidst all of the other destabilizing effects of climate change. That's certainly up there. But part of what makes the problem of a global just transition off of fossil fuels such a pernicious issue of political economy is that that return on investment that might be a public pensioner's retirement fund doesn't come from nowhere. In globalized, financialized capitalism, the value of an investment is generated by exploitation of labor and resources, and often by political power imbalances between the countries involved. If my retirement fund here in the United States moves off of fossil fuel investments and into renewable energy holdings, that's great, but what happens when one of the renewable energy firms I'm invested in increases its own value by privatizing the energy infrastructure of a country in Africa or Asia, placing its people at further risk of energy insecurity? No individual can truly opt out of the global financial system, but participating in it like this draws us deeper into the exploitative web of capitalism. And so the work that the Sierra Club is doing to educate people about their pension funds investments is valuable. I highly encourage folks to read their report and to dig in a little deeper into what they're invested in, whether they are a public worker with a public pension or whether you have a 401k and you don't necessarily know where it's going. But thinking beyond that, how do we fight for working people on the other end of those investments? How do we square the fact that, you know, our savings, our investments might depend on the destruction of someone else's environment or the destabilization of their livelihood? How do we shore up the futures of the 44% of U.S. households and the great majority of the world that don't have a retirement plan at all? These are the important questions that we'll need to answer as we think about what a truly sustainable, democratized economy might look like. But it would be a great first step to try and get involved in learning about more about your pension or your retirement fund and, you know, what might be lurking inside of it. So that's today's show. As always, thank you so much for tuning into The Rift on WEFT 90.1 FM Community Radio out of Champaign, Illinois. You can listen to recordings of The Rift on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and various podcast aggregators out there. The recording of this episode will be up later this evening. Up next, we've got some tunes for a little bit, and then at the top of the hour is On the Move with Herbert Burnett, as usual. I'll be back here for the next episode of The Rift 2 weeks from now on Sunday, March 16th. We'll see you then.
rising. You could go down, keep it rising. I could go down, keep it rising. I said that you could go down, keep it rising. I could go down, keep it rising. You should go down, keep it rising. I could go down, 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 keep it rising. You should go down, keep it rising. I could go down, keep it rising. You should go down, keep it rising. I could go down, 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 rising. I could go down, keep it riding. You should go down, keep it riding. We could go down, keep it riding. She said, boy, don't save my number. Driving 100 miles an hour. But she put her intentions on my tongue. I taste it.
Programming is brought to you in part by the listeners of WEFT, along with our community partners, including Furniture Lounge, The Upper Bout, Josh Gallagher at Edward Jones Financial, and A to Z Painting and Decorating. Listener-supported, volunteer-run since 1981. Community radio for East Central Illinois, 90.1 FM WEFT.
Everybody wanna be a gangster, gangster. Everybody wanna be a bad bitch. Everybody play the game. What will be the legacy? Every day's a masquerade. Hiding hands and throwing shade. All the same, we play the game. What will be the legacy? Everybody wanna be a rock star.
Let Champaign, 90.1 FM, your community radio station since 1981.
And go. Woo!
Perfect.